And thanks to the secretaries for inviting me. It's great to be here. And great to hear a summary of the previous talk as well. I like that tradition. Okay, so the starting point of this talk is going to be the sort of very intuitive idea that free will comes from the Greeks. So the actions of a severe addict, for example, are going to be less free intuitively than the actions of a mild addict. And more generally, the sorts of conditions that are typically thought to undermine or interfere with anyone's free will, things like compulsive disorders, schizophrenia, involuntary intoxication, and so on. All of these things can manifest in symptoms which can be completely debilitating or perfectly manageable or indeed anything in between. And this is reflected to some extent in our legal systems as well. So many criminal justice systems will have partial defenses, precisely for defendants who are judged to, whose actions are judged to have been, in some sense, not fully free. So one example of this, a famous example, is an English case called Campbell, where the defendant killed a hitchhiker on his way back from a hockey match in Oxfordshire in the late 80s, originally convicted of murder, but on appeal it was successfully argued that the significant frontal lobe damage that he had acquired as a result of frequent epileptic seizures had severely impacted his capacity for forward planning, rational thought, and control of his emotions and so on. And so his sentence, well, his charge was reduced from murder to manslaughter. So it wasn't quashed completely, because the thought was he's still in some sense in control of his actions, but it also seems like he wasn't fully free. So this also seems to suggest that free will can come in degrees. But despite this, I think it's fair to say that there have been very few systematic attempts to try and explain in what sense free will comes in degrees. The majority or the vast majority of philosophical work in this area has been devoted to what I call a sort of yes or no question, which is what makes an action free simpliciter or not free simpliciter, and in particular, I guess, whether these conditions are compatible with physical determinism. But the comparative question is really interesting as well, and so I guess the aim of this talk is to make some progress towards a theory of degrees of free will. And my strategy is going to be to start with a popular extant approach to free will, namely the reasons sensitivity approach, and try to extend it to accommodate degrees of freedom. And by way of showing that some of these strategies won't work, I'm hoping to zero in on the view I think does work. I should say now, the positive view especially is still very sketchy. I'm hoping you'll help me fill in the details. But I'm confident that there is an interesting concept to analyze here, and so I'm hoping I can make some progress at least towards analyzing it. I guess one final thing before we jump in. As you may have gathered, this talk forms part of a larger project whose goal is to come up with an account of degrees of moral responsibility, which I think could have some interesting applications to lots of different problems. But this won't be the whole story there, because as well as, if you like, the freedom dimension to moral responsibility, there'll also be other dimensions, like the epistemic dimension, for example, which tracks to what extent an agent knew about the significance and potential consequences of their actions, or maybe should have known about them. I also think there's a causal dimension to moral responsibility, so I think that an agent can be more or less responsible for an outcome in virtue of making a larger or smaller contribution to bringing that outcome about. And then even once we've got all of that in place, there'll still be an additional question of how to aggregate degrees along these three dimensions to arrive at sort of an overall measure of an agent's responsibility. So there's lots of work to do there. This is one small piece of the larger puzzle to try and come up with a theory of degrees of free will. Okay, so what is the reasons responsiveness or reason sensitivity approach to free will? So roughly speaking, it's this. An agent was free in acting only if she was responsive to potential sufficient reasons to act otherwise. Sufficient reason here doesn't mean modally sufficient, it means something like a reason such that if it's present, then acting otherwise is the right thing for us to do, all things considered. So the difference between the addict and the non-addict, for example, is supposed to be that whereas the non-addict was responsive to potential sufficient reasons to act otherwise, the addict wasn't. So an example of such a reason might be, you imagine someone who's addicted to coffee, and then imagine a situation where someone offers them £1 million not to drink coffee. That would be a sufficient reason not to drink coffee. The difference between the addict and the non-addict, for example, is the fact that the addict is not responsive to this reason, this potential reason to act otherwise. Of course, the big challenge for this approach is to explain what it is to be responsive to a reason. And it's really natural, when you first encounter this view, I think, to start by thinking about it in counterfactual terms. So to be responsive to a potential sufficient reason to act otherwise is to be such that, had that reason been present, you would have acted otherwise. So for example, to be responsive to a potential, possible reason, you know, the possibility of someone offering you £1 million not to drink coffee is such that had someone offered you £1 million not to drink coffee, you wouldn't have done it. Turns out that that can't be the right way of cashing it out because of famous so-called Frankfurt cases after the philosopher Harry Frankfurt. Here's one example. Frank is deliberating about whether to shoot Furt. Unbeknownst to him, a neuroscientist has been secretly monitoring Frank's brain processes. The neuroscientist can reliably predict the choices that Frank is about to make by looking at the activity in his brain, and can also manipulate Frank's brain in such a way that guarantees that Frank will shoot Furt. He plans to intervene if he predicts that Frank will not choose to shoot Furt on his own. As it happens, however, Frank chooses to shoot Furt on his own, motivated by his own reasons and without the intervention of the neuroscientist, who correctly predicts that Frank will make that choice. So the intuition here is that Frank's action is perfectly free. And yet, had Frank had a sufficient reason to act otherwise, he still would have acted exactly how he did. He still would have shot Furt, because the neuroscientist would have intervened to ensure that he did. So we want it to come out that Frank is responsive to reasons in this case, even though had sufficient reasons to act otherwise been present, he still would have shot Furt. So we can't quite do it in counterfactual terms, we need to try something else. So a lot of people have tried to come up with weaker conditions on reasons responsiveness in response to these kinds of cases. One well-known one is due to John Martin Fisher and Frank Kravitza. So they distinguish between strong reasons reactivity and weak reasons reactivity. This isn't quite their view. We can talk about why it's not quite their view maybe in Q&A, but this is close enough to get going. S is strongly reasons reactive on their view if and only if had there been a sufficient reason for S to act otherwise, she would have done so and done so for that reason. So that's a sort of counterfactual concept. Whereas she was weakly reasons reactive and acting if and only if there's some possible world in which there was a sufficient reason to act otherwise and she did so for that reason. And this is a weaker condition. So Frank in the Frank and Furt case earlier is not strongly reasons reactive because he would still have acted otherwise had there been a sufficient reason to act otherwise. But he is weakly reasons reactive because there's some possible world where there's a sufficient reason to act otherwise and he does so for that reason, namely one in which the neuroscientist isn't present or doesn't intervene for whatever reason. And so Fisher and Ritzer say that weak reasons reactivity is all you need for free will. Now, there's been a variety of responses to this account, but for our purposes, the interesting thing is that it suggests a way of understanding degrees of free will on a scale, if you like, from weak to strong reasons reactivity. So one way of seeing this is if you just cash out the counterfactual here in possible worlds terms, using a standard possible world to counter counterfactuals, it becomes the view that S was strongly reasons reactive in acting if and only if in every closest possible world in which there's a sufficient reason to act otherwise, S does so for that reason. Whereas weak reasons reactivity just says that S has to act otherwise for that reason, just in some possible world or other, not necessarily the closest ones, where there is such a reason. So in a recent paper, Philip Swenson and Justin Coates, sort of in passing, suggest that we might be able to understand degrees of free will or degrees of responsibility, as they put it, in terms of how close to the actual world the world in which S acts otherwise is. And this isn't quite what they say, but here's a way of reconstructing what they say. So, I'm not sure if you can see this, sorry, can't go back. Let D reason, subscript reason, be the distance from actuality of the closest possible worlds in which there is a sufficient reason to act otherwise. And then D reason plus act here is the distance from actuality of the closest possible worlds in which there's a sufficient reason to act otherwise, and S does so for that reason. And then the thought is we can think of degrees of freedom in terms of just the ratio of these two quantities. So if these two quantities are equal, then S is strongly reasons reactive, because in all the closest possible worlds in which she has a reason, she acts for that reason. But the further away from the closest world in which she has sufficient reason to act otherwise you have to go to find a world where she actually acts for that reason, the less free the agent is. That's the idea. At least I think this is what they're getting at. They don't put it quite in these terms, but I think that's what they're getting at. So this view, I think, does quite well in certain cases. So if you think about the difference between the severe addict and the mild addict, if you like. So someone who's mildly addicted to coffee, they might not refrain from drinking coffee in the closest possible world in which they have a sufficient reason to do that. Maybe the closest such world is one where, they are late for a meeting or something like that, so it would be the right thing to do is not to make coffee, but rather go to your meeting so you're not late. This person will still drink coffee in that situation and just be late for a meeting. But you don't have to go too much further away from actuality to find a world where they are actually responding to the reason. So maybe in a world where you have to walk 2 miles to the nearest shop to get coffee, that's a sufficient reason not to drink coffee. They're not going to drink coffee in that world. Whereas the severe addict, the idea is you really have to go really far away from actuality to find a world where they're actually responding to a sufficient reason to act otherwise. Maybe, for example, you have to think about a world where their life is being threatened if they drink coffee or something like that. So it seems to be roughly in the right ballpark, this view. The problem is that you can come up with Frankfurt-style cases against this view relatively easily. Here's one. So suppose that in this variation of the case, the neuroscientist actually intervenes. So just to be on the safe side, the neuroscientist intervenes to ensure that Frank shoots Fert. In fact, there were no sufficient reasons for Frank not to shoot Fert, but suppose that had there been such a reason, it would have been, say, the presence of a policeman. So maybe let's suppose that a policeman normally patrols around this area, and on this occasion was a few minutes late and so wasn't around. But the closest world in which there is a sufficient reason not to shoot Fert is one where the policeman would have been present, and so that's a reason for Frank not to shoot Fert, because otherwise he'd get caught. But it's also true that had a policeman been present, the neuroscientist wouldn't have intervened, because they don't want to get caught either. And so given this, I think we have a worry for the idea of the analysis of degrees of free will in terms of closeness, because The intuition I take it here is that Frank is minimally free, not at all free. He had no control over his actions at all. His actions were entirely controlled by the neuroscientist. But he counts as maximally free according to closeness, because had there been a sufficient reason for him not to shoot first, that would have been the presence of the policeman, so the neuroscientist wouldn't have intervened, and so he would have acted otherwise for that reason. So he counts as strongly reasons reactive. What I've done there, I guess, is in a sense introduced a backup mechanism to the backup mechanism, which is the sorts of things that, if you know the literature on Frankfurt-style cases, it's the sort of thing that people do there. So the closeness view, I think, doesn't work. And I think the only other discussion of degrees of free will I've been able to find, Montminy and Tinney, I'm afraid I wasn't able to find a photo of Daniel Tinney on the internet. Let me know if one exists for the next time I give this. On the basis of something like this worry, they suggest an amendment to Coates and Swenson's view in terms of closeness. They say, well, we should appeal to whole rafts of possibilities, not just the closest ones. So as they put it, the strength of a mechanism is revealed not by the distance of the closest possibility in which the mechanism performs adequately, but rather by the proportion of nearby possibilities in which the mechanism performs adequately. So here's what I think they're getting at there. Let n this time, subscript reason, be the number of nearby worlds in which there's a sufficient reason for us to act otherwise, and let n reason plus act be the number of nearby worlds in which there's a sufficient reason to act otherwise, and S does so for that reason. And then again, we're just going to let the degree of freedom be the ratio of these two things. It's a bit sloppy because we're talking about numbers of worlds and there's an uncountable infinity of worlds, but set that, those technical things aside for now, and let's see if this does better than the closeness of the system. So I think this does avoid the original worry, because although the closest world in the first variant of this case, although the closest world in which Frank has a sufficient reason not to shoot Bert is one where he doesn't shoot Bert because it's the presence of a policeman, there are still going to be lots of nearby worlds where he has a different sufficient reason not to shoot Bert. Maybe, I don't know, the gun would hurt his hand if he were to shoot it or something like that, where the neuroscientist still intervenes. So in most of the nearby worlds where he has a sufficient reason to act otherwise, the neuroscientist intervenes, and so he still acts the same way he actually did. So that, I think, is why they go for this rather than the closeness one. But I think that can't quite be the right story. You can just tweak the case to come up with something that is a problem for this one too. So again, the neuroscientist in this case intervenes, but Frank has a benevolent friend who's waiting in the wings. And the benevolent friend will let the neuroscientist have his fun, but only if what he makes Frank do is something he doesn't have a sufficient reason not to do. Otherwise, he'll intervene to thwart the neuroscientist's plan. Right? So he's gonna save Frank from the neuroscientist, but not if what the neuroscientist is going to make him do is something he doesn't have a sufficient reason not to do, otherwise he'll just let it happen. In fact, Frank has no sufficient reason not to shoot Bert, so the friend just lets it happen, doesn't get involved. Again, the intuition here is that Frank is minimally free, but now it seems like in most of the nearby worlds where he has a sufficient reason to act otherwise, he'll act otherwise for that reason, because the friend will intervene to thwart the neuroscientist's plan. Again, just by adding sort of backup mechanisms to backup mechanisms, you can always get counterexamples to these sorts of accounts, I think, these sorts of nodal accounts. So I don't think fraction works either. By the way, these sorts of cases are structurally very similar to double prevention cases in the philosophy of causation literature. It's no coincidence, I think, as we'll see, that there's this connection between the two cases. So there's a lot more to say, I think, there. I think I've given you a flavour of how you might start with Fish and Rivers' view, which is, it's been very influential, and try and extend it to accommodate degrees of freedom. But ultimately, I think none of those strategies are really going to work. So we should try something else. So here's a different approach to reason sensitivity, which is due to Carolina Sartorio. I think the place where she presents it most systematically is in her book, Causation and Free Will, which I think is an excellent read if you're looking for recommendations. And she defends what she calls an actual causal sequence view of freedom, which is the view that whether an action is free is fully grounded in its causal history. And in particular, that implies a supervenience claim, so it implies no difference in freedom without a difference in the causal history of the action. So if you've got two actions which have the same causal history in all relevant respects, then either they're both free or they're both not free. There can't be a difference in freedom without a difference in causal history. And a view like this historically hasn't been taken especially seriously, at least in part because of examples like the addict and the non-addict. So if you imagine if you think about the causal histories of the coffee addict's action of drinking coffee and the non-addict's action of drinking coffee, they're going to be very similar. They're both going to involve a desire to drink coffee and various other events that jointly cause the action. In fact, the desires might be equally strong. I don't think it's plausible to say that the only difference between an addict and a non-addict is that the addict's desire is just stronger than the non-addict's desire. The desires might be equally strong. The difference seems to be that the addict couldn't have acted otherwise, whereas the addict could have acted otherwise. But Sartorio doesn't want to appeal to those sorts of facts in her account of free will, because she wants the causal history to do all of the work. She thinks that freedom is entirely grounded in the causal history. So what possible difference could there be in the causal history of the addict's action and the non-addict's action? That, in a nutshell, is why not many people have gone to this view. And the move Sartorio makes, I think, is just really ingenious. Well, I'll leave the punchline. The move she makes is, well, actually, the causal histories of these two actions aren't the same. In particular, there are various absences which are part of the non-addict's, the causal history of the non-addict's action, which aren't part of the causal history of the addict's action. So, for example, the absence of anyone offering them £1 million, well, let's say £1,000, the absence of anyone offering them £1,000 not to drink coffee, that's going to be part of the causal history of the non-addict's action, according to Sartorio. But it's not going to be part of the causal history of the addict's action. Again, it's tempting to justify that by speaking in counterfactual terms, because had the non-addict been offered £1,000 not to drink coffee, they wouldn't have done so, whereas had the addict been offered £1,000 not to drink coffee, they probably still would have done so. It's tempting to cash it out like that. But counterfactual dependence is only a defeasible test for causation. There are lots of cases which reveal that counterfactual dependence is not necessary for causation. In fact, those cases have precisely the same structure as the Frankfurt cases, ones where you have backup mechanisms. So we shouldn't think of it in counterfactual terms. Rather, what we should just say is, look, there are absences which are part of the causal history of the non-addict's action which aren't part of the causal history of the addict's action. That's why they're different. That's why one action is free and the other is not. So there is a difference in causal history. More generally, Sartorio defends this account of reason sensitivity, which goes like this. An agent is reason sensitive in acting a certain way when the agent acts on the basis of, perhaps in addition to the presence of reasons to act in the relevant way, which in this case might be a desire for coffee, for example. Also, the absence of sufficient reasons to refrain from acting in that way, for example, the absence of anyone offering £1,000, not student coffee, for an appropriately wide range of such reasons. On the basis of here, by the way, is intended as a causal locution, so to act on the basis of, say, the presence of a reason is for that reason to have caused or been a cause of your action in a suitably non-deviant way. So there's a worry about deviant causal chains here that Sartorius is trying to control for here, but to a rough approximation, you can just take on the basis of to be caused by, or in a way that's caused by. So again, there's lots of interesting things to say about this view, but the interesting bit of it for our purposes is maybe this bit here. The picture suddenly got bigger, I'm not sure why. The highlighted passage here, for an appropriately wide range. So what that suggests is maybe we can think about degrees of free will in terms of how many reasons an agent was sensitive to, or maybe what fraction of the reasons that there were or could have been the agent was sensitive to. Where sensitive to, in this case, means part of the causal history of the action. And Sartorio, I think, suggestively hints at this in the book a bit later on. So she says this: it's natural to suggest that reason sensitivity will be a function of something like the ratio or proportion of reasons to which the agent is sensitive to the total number of reasons that she has or could have. So maybe we can try and develop this thought and get a better account of degrees of free will. It's going to be a bit rough, but let's give it a go. So let's say that S was causally sensitive to perhaps a merely possible reason R, if and only if she acted on the basis of either the presence or the absence of R. And then let R plus be the set of reasons she actually has to phi, R minus the set of sufficient reasons she could have had not to phi, and then R just be the union of these two things. And then let's consider this. So S's degree of freedom in phiing is equal to the fraction of elements of R to which she was causally sensitive. So the fraction of the total reasons she had and absences of reasons she could have had that were part of the causal history of her action. So I think this this account is much better. I think it gets the right result in the sort of Frankfurt cases we've looked at earlier. So for example, in the original case, it'll turn out that Frank has a high degree of freedom because a lot of the reasons that Frank had for shooting Bert and a lot of the reasons he could have had not to shoot Bert are going to figure in the causal history of his action, whereas the causal history of his action in the case where the neuroscientist intervenes doesn't involve any reasons at all, it just involves the neuroscientist's action. So it seems to get the right result there. I think it still doesn't work, though, and we're nearly at my view now. I think it still doesn't work, though. So to see this, consider the following case. Suppose Rosie and Jim both have two individually sufficient reasons to eat a tasty apple. Firstly, they like apples, and secondly, apples are healthy. But whereas Rosie acts on the basis of both reasons, so her act was overdetermined by two sufficient reasons, Jim only acted on the basis of one of them, his desire for apples, and all else is equal. So it's a bit fiddly here, but at least my intuition about this case is that they're equally free. They're both fully free, basically. There's no impediment to their freedom. But according to sensitivity, it's going to turn out that Rosie is more free than Jim, because more of the available reasons out there are part of the causal history of Rosie's action than Jim's action. And that just seems like the wrong result to me. And I put this to Carolina a few weeks ago, and what she said in response was that actually what she meant in that passage was only about the reasons to act otherwise. It wasn't about the presence of reasons to act. So she was trying to defend something more like this view, that S's degree of freedom in firing is equal to the fraction of elements of R minus, which was causally sensitive, where R minus, remember, is the set of sufficient reasons to act otherwise. So it doesn't matter if your action was caused by lots of reasons to act in that way. What matters is just that your action was caused by the absences of lots of reasons not to act that way. But then I worry that the account doesn't work for a different sort of reason. So as Sartoria herself acknowledges, there could be an act for which there's no potential sufficient reason to refrain from acting in that way. Consider as an example S's act of pushing a button that will prevent the torture of her infant child, or that will save humanity from destruction. These seem like actions for which there just couldn't have been a sufficient reason to act otherwise. Or at least Sartoria seems to think that there are such actions. But in that case, R minus here is going to be empty. There are no possible reasons which would be sufficient reasons to act otherwise. And so the ratio appealed to in this condition is going to be undefined. It's going to be a fraction of zero. And so we shouldn't be able to make sense of degrees of free will in these cases. But I think we can still make sense of degrees of free will in these cases. I mean, suppose someone didn't push the button out of a desire to save humanity from destruction, but just because of a button-pushing compulsion, then we'd say that their action wasn't free. And maybe their degree of freedom depends on the extent to which it was caused by the compulsion or caused by the reason. I think we can make perfect sense of degrees of free will, even in cases where there are no potentially sufficient reasons to act otherwise. So I guess the take-home message, or the message that I take from all of this, I guess this is the most important bit of the talk, that what seems to be important for how free your action is not how many reasons you are sensitive to, or what fraction of the available reasons you are sensitive to, but how sensitive you are to those reasons. So in this case, for example, what matters is not how many reasons you're sensitive to, but how sensitive you were to the one big reason to push the button, namely, that if you don't, humanity will be destroyed. But Sartoria doesn't seem to have a way of accounting for that, because for her, sensitivity is all or nothing. Either the reason is part of the causal history of the action, or it wasn't. So we have a problem. Now, I think we can make sense of degrees of sensitivity within Sartoria's framework. To do so, we need a notion of degrees of causal contribution. So, on the view I'm going to end up defending, an agent's degree of free will, or an action's degree of free will, is equal to the extent to which that action was caused by reasons, rather than other features of the environment. This isn't, just as a sort of sociological aside, this isn't a strategy Sartoria herself is going to be likely to go for, because she's recently published a paper arguing that talk of degrees of causation make no sense. So I'm hoping to convince her that she should recant on that, because apart from other things, it would get her a nice account of degrees of free will. How much time do I have?
You've got 10 minutes.
10 minutes, good. Okay. So I'll try and say a little bit in the time I have left about what I mean by degrees of causal contribution, and then put all the pieces back together. So it's often natural in many cases to say that one event was more of a cause of some effect than some other event. So you see this all the time in lots of different disciplines, in science, in humanities, in history, in social science, and so on. For example, a historian might say that nationalism was more of a cause of the First World War than the military mobilization schedules or something like that. Unfortunately, there's a variety of things one might mean by this equation, so it's important to mention them, some of them, and set them aside. So one way of being more of a cause of an effect is by causing a larger part of it. So if I steal £100 from Ruth and Lucy steals £500 from him, then Lucy's action was more of a cause of Eric's total losses than my action, because it caused a larger part of those total losses. But often we can't divide up the effects like that, such that each part was caused by a different cause. So suppose that I water a plant and expose it to sunlight and it grows to a meter tall. Had I not watered it, it would have grown to 20 centimeters tall, and had I not exposed it to sunlight, it would have grown to 30 centimeters tall. So we can't divide up the plant's height here and say, well, this portion of the height was caused by the watering and this portion of the height was caused by the sunlight. But we can still make sense of there's still a sense in which the watering was more of a cause because it made more of a difference. So the difference between what would have happened if I hadn't watered it and what actually happened is greater than what would have happened than the difference between what would have happened if I'd not exposed it to sunlight and what actually happened. So that's another thing we might mean by more of a cause. Made more of a difference. But I think there are cases where neither of these notions apply, but where we can still make sense of degrees of causal contribution. So think about the causes of Trump's election. So every vote for Trump was a cause of his election, right? But no vote caused any part of Trump's election. And similarly, no vote made any difference to whether and to how Trump was elected, because if any one person had voted for someone else, Trump would still have been elected in more or less exactly the same way he actually was. But I think we can still make sense of degrees of causal contribution here. So if a particular voter was very influential, maybe he made more of a contribution. Or as was frequently discussed at the time, I think if someone voted in a state with a small population, so a state that was overrepresented in the Electoral College, there might be a sense in which they made a larger contribution to the election than someone voting in California, for example. So I think we can still make sense of degrees of causal contribution, even in the cases where neither of these measures apply. So in previous work, I've tried to come up with an account of causal contribution that that can handle these sorts of cases as well. It's based on what's sometimes called the Ness account of causation, where Ness here stands for necessary element of a sufficient set. This is how I put the view. A plurality of events, x1 to xn, will collectively cause an effect E, if and only if they were jointly sufficient for E, and no proper subplurality of x1 to xn was jointly sufficient for E. So x1 to xn was jointly sufficient, and if you take any one of those events away, what you're left with is something that's no longer jointly sufficient. So they're all non-redundant. So they're all necessary for the sufficiency of all of them together. I think it's a nice, there's a few details to spell out, but I think it's a nice account of causation to start with. And then to be a cause of an event on this view is to just be one of a plurality of events that collectively caused it. Just as to be an author of a book is to be one of a plurality of people who collectively authored it. So X caused Y and X is a cause of Y are not synonymous on this view. To cause Y is to be sufficient for Y. To be a cause of Y is to be one of a plurality of events that were jointly sufficient for Y. So the analogy with authoring, I think, is helpful. So authoring is a non-scalar relation, which is to say that you can't author a book a lot. You can't author a book more than someone else authored a book. It doesn't make sense. But it's nevertheless a relation to which multiple people can contribute to different degrees. So Russell and Whitehead collectively authored the Principia Mathematica, and it makes perfect sense to say that Russell contributed more to the authoring of the book than Whitehead. Maybe because he wrote a larger part of it, but maybe not. Maybe he just contributed, maybe he just came up with the majority of the ideas or did the bulk of the research or something like that. So I think similarly, causing has the same properties. It's a non-scalar relation. You can't cause an event a lot. You can't cause an event more than some other event caused it. But it's a relation to which multiple events can contribute to different degrees. So when a plurality of events were jointly sufficient for an effect, then you can sensibly describe one of them as making a larger contribution to that causing of the effect than a different event did. And roughly speaking, it will be, you know, how much did this event contribute to making all of these together jointly sufficient? So that's how I'm understanding degrees of causal contribution. It's not how much did you contribute to the effect, but how much did you contribute to a particular causing of the effect, where a causing of the effect is something that's jointly sufficient. There's a way of catching that out in probabilistic terms, which I won't go through, but that's the rough idea. So how does all of this apply to freedom? Well, here's roughly what I think might work as a theory of degrees of free will, and then I'll stop and you can poke holes in it. So I'm going to say that an action is fully free if it was fully caused by reasons, i.e. if it was caused by a plurality of events, all of which are reasons to act, or absences of reasons not to act. So if there's a causing of the act, which was made up entirely of reasons, then it was fully free. Of course, not every causing will be like that, because apart from anything else, actions were caused by events in the distant past before any reasons existed. But as long as there's a causing that's only involving reasons, then it's fully free. If it was not even partly caused by reasons, so if there were no reasons in the history of the causal history of the action at all, and it was fully unfree, wholly unfree, and otherwise it would be partially free. So if it's partly caused by reasons and partly caused by features of the agent's environment, then it's partially free. And either way, the action's degree of freedom is equal to the maximum degree of contribution that reasons made to the causing of the action. Maximum because, as I say again, there'll be multiple different causings, so we want to look at the one with the maximum degree of contribution. So that's the idea. And what it's supposed to capture is this idea that that actions can be partly caused by reasons and partly caused by other things. And the more it's caused by reasons, effectively, the more free will the agent has. There's a way of making that vivid, I think, which is by references what's sometimes called the situationist threat to moral responsibility. So this is something that's come out of a variety of studies in psychology and social science. So one famous one is where participants were split into two groups. The first group found a dime in a phone box. The other group didn't find a dime in the phone box. And then a confederate of the experimenters walked past the phone box as the person left and dropped a manila full of papers. What the experimenters found was that the people who found the dime in the phone box were vastly more likely to help than the people who didn't find the dime in the phone box. And when presented with these sorts of cases, there's a feeling, I think, that our actions might not be as free as we thought they were. And therefore that we're not as morally responsible for our actions as we thought we were. And I think my account can explain that, because what these cases show is that in cases like this, reasons to act are not themselves sufficient in the circumstances for acting. Also, the various aspects of the circumstances had to be just right. For example, I had to be dying in the phone box. Now, one thing you might be thinking here is, well, surely every action is caused not just by actions, not just by reasons, because no set of reasons is going to be sufficient by itself for the action. Apart from anything else, the failure of the world to explode and so on is going to be the cause of every action. Notice that I said sufficient in the circumstances here. So there's this sort of free variable of doing a lot of theoretical work here. You only have to be sufficient in the circumstances. And I guess there's two different ways you can go here in response to these sorts of things. One thing you could do is be a contextualist about the circumstances. So you could say, just relativize degrees of free will to a choice of background conditions. In the same way that I guess contextualists about knowledge say that you know only relative to particular context here, similarly you have a degree of freedom only relative to a particular context. Or you need to say something about what the right background conditions are for evaluating degrees of freedom. So for example, is it right to just hold fixed the fact that the agent found a diamond in the phone box? Or should that be thought of as part of the causal history of the action, and therefore as something which is going to reduce the agent's degree of free will? So that's a sort of interesting choice point that the account presents, and that I haven't sort of figured out exactly what I think about. But at least the view can make some sense of why our sense of ourselves as free agents might be threatened by these kinds of experiments from psychology and social science. And I think that's it. Thank you.